you so desire. So just like the term Puritan or Puritanical, there can be a positive spin on the Puritans and a very, very negative spin on the Puritans. And Pietism is kind of the same way. There can be kind of a positive understanding of it, and then there can also be sort of this understanding of, pious. You're pompous and you're pious. You're Pharisaical, in other words. But really, Pietism as a movement would be the idea of internal spiritual individualism. So Pietism emphasizes the individual's relationship with God. It emphasizes the internal need for a real relationship with God, not just forms and sort of formality. And so we are very influenced by this. You listen to the applications to my sermons, and very often they are to you and I, not so much to we together. So there's this individual application of the Scriptures, individual relationship with God, emphasis on personal salvation. All of those things are somewhat connected to Pietism. And so there's some value that comes to us because of that emphasis. But also, you can have a very much too internalized. It can be too individualistic in your relationship with God, and you can just kind of be out there as a Lone Ranger Christian, and that would be a negative effect of Pietism. Now, look at the second major bullet point. This is a kind of a semi-formal definition of who the Puritans were. The Puritans were a group of English Reformed Protestants in the 16th and 17th centuries who sought to purify the Church of England from its Catholic practices, maintaining that the Church of England was only partially Reformed. Now, the reason that it was only partially Reformed, as far as I'm concerned, is because it was a primarily politically motivated Reformation. From Henry VIII on down, they just wanted away from the shackles of the Catholic Church and the Pope. And then, as Elizabeth kind of established this Puritanism, what she wanted was a middle-of-the-road, moderate religion that could unite all English people. And she wanted to enforce that. She didn't want Catholicism. She didn't want, radical reformers to have any influence. So they were dissatisfied with the degree to which the English church was reformed away from Catholicism. It was founded primarily by ministers who had been in exile under Mary Tudor, who is known as Bloody Mary because of her assassination or persecution of so many Puritans and Reformed people and, Protestants. Basically, she was trying to take the nation back to Catholicism. And yet, these ministers, having gone into exile, returned when Elizabeth took the throne in 1558. What did they object to? They especially objected to being required to use the Common Book of Prayer. They didn't like the clerical dress. I mean, Anglican priests can look just as fancy as a Roman Catholic. High church formality, booming organs, stained glass, all of those kinds of things. The pomp and circumstance. One of the things that would have especially offended them would have been any kind of precious metals. So gold crosses on the altar, golden offering plates, that sort of thing. They also would have objected to the elevation of the host. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? They would take the bread and they would carry it in, held high, at the beginning of the service and place it on the altar before the service began. It was a lot of you know, pomp and circumstance that went with that. And then some of them objected to the church hierarchy, there being bishops. So there's deacons and priests and bishops and then the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they objected to that because it bound their conscience. Sometimes their boss would tell them to do things they didn't want to do. So eventually, and this now we're going to kind of review a little bit from last week. Eventually, Puritans came into Parliament, and they became the majority of Parliament, and eventually they started the Civil War, cut off the king's head, and it started the protectorate under Oliver Cromwell. However, that only lasted for a limited period of time. Once Cromwell died and his son failed to be a very effective leader, they called for Charles II to come back, and he was so Charles II came back, and then his son, I believe, or his brother, I can't remember how it all worked, but his heir to the throne obviously was trying to take the English back to Catholicism. So instead of, they invited a new king and queen to come. So William and Mary came, and they started something called the Act of Uniformity, which I will talk about in a second. But because of the Act of Uniformity, 2,000 preachers, 2,000 pastors had to flee. They were taken out of their pulpits. They were turned out of their parishes. They had nowhere to go. They had no way to provide for their families. So 2,000 ministers. I mean, that would make waves here in the United States, and there are tens of thousands of pastors here. But there, you were assigned to a parish, and there was one preacher or one pastor per parish, unless you had an assistant, so you worked together. There was no demot in the English world. There was one church per parish, period. And you had a pastor, and you maybe had an assistant. That was kind of it, you know. And so these guys are just booted out. You have all of these pastorless churches. They are now replaced by good Anglicans because of this Act of Uniformity. And because of this Act of Uniformity, these 2,000 ministers became known as nonconformists and dissenters, but they are primarily made up of Puritans. They are nonconformists because they are Puritans and they object to these things that we've already talked about. And they paid a heavy price for living according to their conscience. And we'll talk about that some more in a moment. So what is the Act of Uniformity? And then there's some other legislation that goes with it. So you see the bullet points under the Act of Uniformity. The Act of Corporation in 1661 required that all municipal officers take Anglican communion. So you cannot be a dissenter and be a nonconformist. I'm sorry, you cannot be a dissenter and be a town official. You can't get into politics. You can't have a position of any power. And then the Act of Uniformity, which is the name for one specific piece of legislation, in 1662 required that the Book of Common Prayer be used in all worship in all of England. So the Book of Common Prayer is like a pastor's manual. It tells you how to do a wedding. It tells you how to do a prayer service. It tells you what text to preach on and certain days of the year. It tells you prayers to pray. It tells you what to do and say when you go to visit the sick and the dying and how to do funerals. And I mean, it's a pastor's handbook. And there is some quality material in there, but these guys are basically saying, that's not what we want to do. We don't want to be bound to do this sort of thing. And there is some theology in there that they questioned. So this is a theological argument that they have with the Book of Common Prayer, as well as just a conscience kind of thing. They don't want their conscience to be bound by these detailed instructions. And then the Conventicle Act, which basically just meant more than five people could not gather for worship outside the Anglican Church. So you could basically have family devotions, and that was basically it. Is that, you follow there? That you were not allowed to gather. So do we not have a constitutional right to free assembly? here in the United States? They did not. Why do you think that we have a constitutional right to free assembly here in the United States? Because they were so sick and tired of this, the Conventicle Act. Then there was the 5-Mile Act. So basically, if you had been kicked out of your pulpit as a pastor, you were no longer allowed to come within 5 miles of your old parish or any other small town in the whole land. So in other words, they kept you in the urban areas where they could keep an eye on you. And they could watch. Were you gathering with more than 5 people? Were you preaching in the backyard? They could tell. There were enough people to observe you and turn you in. J.I. Packer is a significant scholar regarding the Puritans, who is still living, amazingly so. Every time I see him on anything, it looks like a puff of wind would blow him over, but nevertheless, he is still living. And he did his PhD on Richard Baxter, who we're going to talk about here in a minute. Anyway, J.I. Packer has written extensively on the Puritans, and he says that their suffering made them a generation of spiritual giants. It forced them, this suffering, this official persecution, didn't kill them. And some of them did die, actually. Died in prison, were persecuted to death. But nevertheless, for the most part, it wasn't like the Roman Empire persecution, not that. But this persecution, this constant kind of segregation, this constant discrimination, you might say, against them, force them to dig their spiritual wells much deeper. And they do have deep wells from which to draw. Now I want to talk about the spirit, some of the Puritan ideals that are a part of sort of their heritage. What is it that they have passed on to us? And then we'll talk about 3 specific ones. But let me stop here and ask if there's any questions or comments that you'd like to bring up about the Puritan movement. Don.
What differences are between Roman Catholicism and Anglicanism apart? Anglicans, are they still an earned grace group?
I don't really know enough about the Anglican system to answer that question, but I'll try anyway. So I think that we might make some comparison between our understanding of the Methodists and the Anglicans. And of course, they are kind of connected. The Methodist theological statements, at least as far as I know, are still probably pretty good.
They're Arminians.
I know. I know that. So
they were reformed in practice?
No. So the English church, the Anglican church, the 39 articles are Calvinistic. Their practice, however, remained quite formal in many cases, but could be very informal in other cases. Their enforcement was negligible. So there were many what are called Anglo-Catholics in the Anglican Church. They would like to return. They would like to merge. All of those kinds of things. What's that? They are not faithful. Those individuals and those churches are unfaithful to their original documents. So formally, they are reformed, theologically. But their practice since the beginning has been very high church and formal, and their enforcement. They have not required ministers to genuinely confess the 39 articles, which is their statement of faith. That's the best answer. So let me just pause there. J.I. Packer, in the, I think, 50s and 60s, and those like him, J.I. Packer is an Anglican, they really thought that the evangelical movement would take over the Anglican Church. And they pressed and pushed for renewal. But they failed. They were unable to do so. And eventually, J.I. Packer was kicked out of the Anglican Communion that he was a part of. And then he joined a smaller one, which is headquartered in Africa, because African Anglicans are more conservative.
So Episcopalians are American Anglicans?
That's correct. Episcopalians are American Anglicans. And the big Episcopalian denomination in the United States or in North America kicked J.I. Packer out, and he just went down the street and joined a different Anglican church. The Anglican Communion is what it's called, the one that's headquartered in Africa. And they are, you know, Africans are more conservative. They're more socially conservative, and they don't want the approval of the church being placed on homosexuality. So, any other questions or comments about this? So we would say that the seeds of the degeneration of doctrine and practice in the Anglican Church were there from the very beginning. These people that we associate with more, these Puritans, they were objecting from the very beginning.
But objecting mostly to practice.
Mostly to practice, yes. And to compromise. Because, you know, they knew that some closet Catholics were still there. Yeah. Go ahead.
I know a guy who goes to the church on Maryville, and he says, if you're just there, you would think it's a Catholic service because the practices are the same. But he's adamant that the theology is not that.
Right. That they're.
He says, probably when people come that are Catholic, they think it's the same, and they realize it's not. People who aren't Catholic come and think it's Catholic.
So is it a relatively small church? Yeah. So Anglicanism has a particular appeal today. And so, like I said, we have been especially influenced by individualistic, internalized religion in evangelicalism. Right? And there are some pitfalls to that. We need the communion of saints to lift us up. And then if you kind of think back to the fundamentalist movement was a fight against liberalism, but once that fight was won, fundamentalists just kind of fought among themselves, or we could even say we fought among ourselves. We might be included as a part of this kind of the heritage of this movement. And so there were such a thing as independent, non-denominational churches, right? That is the influence of the pietistic movement on Community Bible Church, okay? And so the pendulum in these movements is always swinging. And people have noticed that being super independent isn't really biblical. Being super individualistic is not really biblical. Now, yes, we need a personal relationship with God, but that needs to be in the context of a congregation, right? And so many churches, Christians, ministers, pastors have realized there's some value to denominations and the sort of community that brings. And so, for example, my sister's boss is an Anglican. He goes to one of these very conservative Anglican churches where the theology, the doctrine, the practice, you know, you wouldn't know if you walked in that it was an Anglican church. It certainly would not look or feel Catholic. They don't elevate the host. However, they baptize babies and they have communion every single week. So those are, you know, things that's out there. I know of many people who they love the kind of service that it provides. There's a more formal feel to it, but not in a shallow way, more in a serious, you know, we're very, there's a lot of scripture reading, there's recitations back and forth between the pastor and the congregation. And so they feel that pull. And if you're an Anglican, because of the British Empire in past years, you have Anglican brothers and sisters all over the world. And they love that feel of community, which, of course, the Catholic Church also provides, because there's Catholics on the North Pole, as far as I know. I mean, just there's the Catholic Church is everywhere. It has, you know, spread throughout the world. And the Anglican Church, in some form or another, is the closest Protestant replacement for that. So that's the reason many people are drawn to that. And there's been a resurgence of Anglicanism in our lifetimes. So what about us? Where does that leave us? We are the, we're down the generations, but we're a part of this pietistic movement. And if we wanted to join a denomination, we would have to disband and rewrite our constitution and start our church over with again. I mean, this is not, being in a denomination is not in our DNA, right? It is, in fact, it is in our church DNA to not be in a denomination. But I will say this, what have I done as a pastor? I have tried to build fellowship into my own ministry with fellow pastors and fellowship with other churches into our church existence so that we are not isolated as a result of our pietism. So, any comments about that little rabbit trail? So a congregationalist, most of the Puritans got kicked out, and they became a variety of different things, but most of them became congregationalists. So I'm trying to remember if I even know what some of the other ones became. Some of them may have become Baptists, but congregationalists... So like Jonathan Edwards pastored the Congregational Church of Northampton, Massachusetts. So these Puritans... Oh, no, let me back up. Some of these Puritans did not object to the hierarchy, and they were willing to have bishops over them. But if you were a Puritan that did not want a bishop over you, you were a Congregationalist. You wanted your congregation to rule. So some of these Puritans were Presbyterian. Some of them were Congregationalists. Anything else? All right. Let's talk about some of their ideals. This won't be news to most of you, but religiously, once they were ejected from the Church of England, they wanted to form independent dissenting churches that were pure. By the way, the word Puritan was originally used as a term of attack. You know, you are a Puritan. You are somebody who wants to be more pure than is humanly possible. Both in your life and in the church. You're too strict. That's what the way it was originally used. And it's because of this. They wanted churches that were pure. That meant obedience to God in every detail of life and submission to God within the church to the greatest degree possible. So they wanted their individual members to be truly saved. They wanted them to be obedient to the Word of God, and they wanted their church to reflect the pattern of church life in the Bible, given to us in the book of Acts, as well as the pastoral epistles. They were serious about the scriptures. You know, there are these legends of Puritan preachers, you know, preaching 200 sermons on the book of Isaiah, and he finally got to chapter 3. Okay? I mean, just, they, you know, which I don't think is wise. But, you know, the most direct kind of influence in modern times would be Martin Lloyd-Jones. His sermons on the book of Ephesians fills 6 volumes. You know, and I use them sometimes, especially when I was preaching through the book of Ephesians, I use them. But there was no way I could read his several sermons on what was just going to be one for me, you know. But he was especially gifted in that. I think his sermons on the book of Romans fill 9 volumes, and he didn't even finish. He retired before he got done. So, these guys, they dug deep into the Bible. They were serious about salvation. They wanted you to show evidence of your salvation. And in fact, they could go overboard on this. They could be too introspective at times. They could be too much of, we're going to examine you to make sure that you're really a Christian before you are allowed to take communion. This could be a little bit overboard at times. We are going to talk about some of these Puritan leaders were not all as Calvinistic as others. And even when it came to salvation, you do get the impression sometimes that some of them wanted you to be sort of so resigned to the sovereignty of God of salvation that you were sort of willing to put up with the idea of going to hell. That you almost... we all agree that we deserve to go to hell, but they were supposed to sort of be, some of them taught that you were to be resigned to that before you were really able to seek salvation. So I think we should want heaven, even though we know good and well that we deserve hell. And they were very serious about church. Go on to family. The Puritans thought of the family as a little church. So each individual Christian family was supposed to be like a little church. The husbands and the fathers were to shepherd their flock. He was to be the pastor of the flock. They did emphasize that wives and children were called to be submissive. Wives and mothers also carried significant influence in the home. They were responsible over family affairs. They had remarkable authority and very often managed the investments of her husband. She would run his businesses sometimes in this particular kind of culture. And they emphasized family, Bible reading, and prayer. They also looked at any servants that a Puritan family had as a part of the family, and the father was supposed to disciple them as well. Puritans are often thought of as killjoys, as sexual killjoys in particular. However, they sure had a lot of kids. Okay? And there is a great degree of evidence that husbands and wives genuinely and truly loved one another in every sense of that word. In fact, in Massachusetts, 1/6, in colonial Massachusetts, 1/6 of all divorces were about sex, specifically because the husband could not or would not fulfill his responsibilities to his wife. So this was important, actually, to them, partly because they needed children. And there's one specific instance where a man would not fulfill his sexual obligations to his wife, and they banished him. They made him live in exile in the wilderness. Perhaps they blushed less when it came to these things, but nevertheless, they took them seriously. And there was an intention that there would be a physical intimacy and tenderness between husband and wife, and they were far from being killjoys, unless you were unwilling to be physically tender and intimate. And then, buddy, getting your butt kicked out to the sticks. So, anyway. Any questions on that? All right, Greg, whatever.
They do not.
You would think that they do, but theologically, they are very, very different. And the colonies, the Puritan colonies in Massachusetts hung a couple of Quakers for violating sort of heresy-type laws. So the Quakers are super pietistic. They don't even have a preacher in their service. They sit around and wait for an inner light, and you may sit there silently for the entire service, or someone may receive an inner light, you know, kind of the special private revelation, and they may speak. But there is no trained pastor in Quakerism. They were seen as heretics, and they are, really. The Quaker theology really is heresy. And so they were not tolerated by the Puritans. And so they would tend to leave and go where? Anybody? American history? Are you sure about that, or is that a guess? Okay, I'll let that stand, but they're somewhere else. Right. William Tell, right? Wasn't it William Tell? William Penn. William Penn was a Quaker, so what colony did he start? Pennsylvania, right. So so you got kicked out of Massachusetts for being a Quaker, and you either went to Rhode Island or to Pennsylvania. If you got kicked out for being a Catholic, where did you go? Yes, but where? Maryland, right? So. No, I'm serious. I mean, it is kind of humorous, but I'm serious. That's the reason it's called Maryland. It was a place for... That's where Catholics went. That's true. Yeah. All right. So any follow-up question there about Quakers and whatnot? Quaker State Oil? Yes, go ahead.
So Amish Mennonite, are they...
They are from the same stock in Europe and would have felt comfortable in the same colony here in the United States. Yeah. So in Mennonite churches, you will find some who are very works-oriented, and then you will find some who have a good, solid understanding of grace. There's a lot of variety there. Jenny's grandfather was a Baptist pastor in Pennsylvania. I never met him. He died. I'm not even sure if Jenny remembers him or not. But one time I went with her. We've been back a few times to her, you know, that part of Pennsylvania where her family was from, that side of her family. And we met Uncle Snavely. Okay, we met Uncle Snavely, who was Jenny's grandma's brother. And he said to me that Pastor Hurd, I can't remember his first name, Pastor Hurd sure had a lot to teach us old Mennonites about grace. So as he had a, you know, there was a man with an, you know, an understanding of salvation by grace through faith who had an influence there in Pennsylvania among those Mennonites, yeah. Particularly those who were part of his family. So, yeah. All right, let's talk about education. Puritans in New England were required to hire a town schoolmaster to teach the children to read, so there would be some home education early on. Then they would go to school, and they would be taught. Actually, I think if I remember correctly, they were forced to hire one so that they could be taught to write. So they're probably their mother taught them to read. Then they were taught to write. And the leaders of Massachusetts colony were all very highly educated men who, many of them, graduated from Oxford and Cambridge. And eventually they started Harvard, you know, the quintessential Ivy League school here in the United States. And then they, I don't have anything under this in your notes, but they also believed in Reformation and revival. They wanted to build the New Jerusalem in the New World. They were especially the Puritans in New England, were post-millennialists. They thought that the church would rise, the church would win the world to Christ, and that Christ would come back to sit upon his throne for a millennial reign here upon the earth, but that we ushered in, the church ushered in the millennium by evangelism. So when they got here, what was one of the first things that they did? They started evangelizing the Indians. Okay, they wanted to be a city set upon a hill. They wanted a complete and full reformation, and they saw revival as both evangelism and reforming the church and Christians' lives according to God's word. And they experienced revivals. There were spotty revivals all the time. They had days of fasting and prayer, and of course, the Great Awakening under the leadership of George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards was the result of this sort of revivalistic fervor of these Puritan people. Any comments or questions there? All right. Teenagers, any comments or questions? Who won the most tic-tac-toe? I noticed there was a certain point at which you guys stopped playing tic-tac-toe. I'm done for now. Please bring these sheets back, and we will talk about John Owen. We will talk about Richard Baxter and John Bunyan. Those are the only three Puritans that I've actually read a full book of their writings. So I figured they would be the ones I should talk about. But they're good examples of Puritan leaders. All right, bring those sheets back next week, and we'll be done for now.